teacher, Adam Brown. Because since this morning till now, Adam Brown has been sharing a lot of wisdom with friends and the devotees and his fans around the globe. And it's a great privilege to have him at our temple. And of course, I don't need to introduce him because you all know him, who Adam Brown is. And so with much respect and deep gratitude, with the joint palms, let us welcome Adam Brown for this public to say sadhu.
Sadhu.
It wasn't loud enough.
Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay. So that's important. Whatever you do in life, always give it lots of energy. So when we talk about right livelihood, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about tonight, sometimes it's not just the livelihood, the profession you do, but what you make out of it makes it right livelihood or wrong livelihood. And there was one teaching, I remember this man came to see me in Australia some years ago, and he said that when he heard of my teacher, Ajahn Chah, and heard that he was a very wise man, that he went all the way from Sydney to Thailand for one purpose, just to see this great master, this monk, and ask him all the questions which he had. And it's a long way. And he went there just for that one reason. When he got to Ajahn Chah's monastery, Ajahn Chah was surrounded by hundreds of people. And this Australian Caucasian just had to sit on the edge and wait for his turn. An hour, 2 hours went past, and this man was no closer to asking his question than when he first came. He realized these monks are too popular, too famous, he would not be able to ask his question. So he got up and left, disappointed. When he got up and left, he realized his taxi taking him back to the airport to fly on the first leg back to Sydney was not going to be arriving for another hour. So he didn't have anything else to do. He picked up a broom and started helping sweeping the monastery grounds. So all of you, if you want to get really lucky, clean up after this talk. You know, I'm just going on a tangent here. Once there were five fingers, and these five fingers were arguing who was the most important. And first of all, the thumb said, I am the most important. I am the okay finger. When you say okay, me, I'm okay, okay. And I am the fattest and the strongest. I am the opposable thumb which allows you to pick up things. I am the most important, the most powerful. I am the okay finger. I am the best. And this finger said, no, 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 no. When you say number one, you put me up. I'm the number one finger. I am the index finger. I point out things for people. I am the finger of wisdom. Therefore, I am the most important. And then the middle finger put itself up. I am the tallest. I see furthest. I am the middle way finger. The middle. And look, if you don't believe me, I am so powerful. If you put me up the other way, people get very upset. I am the best and most powerful. And then this finger said, no. I am the most important because I am the finger of love. When you get engaged, I get the engagement ring. When you get married, I get the wedding ring. I am the finger of love. And without love, where would this world be? That's why I am the most important finger. And that left this little fellow. And this little finger said, most people think I'm insignificant, unimportant. And many of you use me to do dirty things. But even though I do many dirty things, when you pray to the Buddha, I am closest to the Buddha. So, those of you who clean up after this retreat, you are like the little finger. You are closest to the Buddha and the most important. So, clean up afterwards. So, this man, he went to see Ajahn Chah, couldn't see him, picked up a broom and started sweeping. And after only about 10 minutes, he said, he felt a hand on his shoulder, turned around, and that hand belonged to Ajahn Chah. You know, monks are very wise and kind. Sometimes Ajahn Chah saw this man, knew he'd come from such a long distance, unable to ask his question, so Ajahn Chah got up and went to him to give him some advice. And through the translator, all Ajahn Chah said was just maybe one line, one sentence, which changed this man's life. He said, "If you are going to sweep, give it everything you've got." And then Ajahn Chah left. And he realized this wasn't about just making the monastery grounds clean. It was far more profound than that. He went back to Sydney happy. His work, his little company, he gave it everything he got and became highly successful. When he went home and met his family, he gave his wife and kids everything he got, really looked after them, cared for them. When he went to bed at night, he gave sleep everything he got. He wasn't worried about the work tomorrow morning. This was not work time. He gave sleep, rest, everything he got. When he meditated, he wasn't concerned about his wife and his kids and his work. When he meditated, he gave meditation everything he'd got. And he became very happy, healthy, great family, and very rich. A simple thing like that. Whatever you do, give it everything you've got. Which is one of the reasons I'm very happy that when you did sadhus, you give it everything you've got. There's nothing more depressing than after a talk which I put so much energy in, people say, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." It's like I want to kill myself afterwards. So depressing. So give it everything you've got. Give it all from power. Whatever you do in life, give it energy. And don't think you get tired that way. The Buddha said you generate energy by putting so much effort and energy and happiness into what you're doing. You get more energy than ever. So whatever you do in your life, number one, whatever career, whatever livelihood, give it everything you've got. And once you put give it everything you've got, you know, it's also just you learn that your job, your profession, is not just for making money. You give employment to so many people. You keep the economy going. Create taxes so you can have hospitals, so you can have roads and everything else. That your job is a service for so many other people. And sometimes we forget that. This guy came to see me and said, "I'm in a dead-end job. All I do is drive buses all day. And I'm not an accountant, I haven't started my own business, I just drive buses, that's a really terrible livelihood." No, it's not. It depends how you drive that bus. And I told him, "Look, every passenger who comes on your bus, smile at them, be kind to them, wish them a happy day. Whatever it is, just go that little bit extra, a smile, a little bit of happiness doesn't cost the bus company anything, it doesn't slow down your schedule. And if you can do things like that, it's amazing just the effect you can have on hundreds of people. Thousands of the people who use your bus have a happy bus driver to start their day or to finish their day. You have stopped many suicides." When I say things like that, he really got it. And he had a wonderful life as a bus driver. A happy bus driver who took people from what place they want to where they want to go to, and always happy and contributing immensely to society. So these are examples. It's not the job you do, but it's how you do it makes it right livelihood or wrong livelihood. And you've got to have some money to look after your family. unless you're a monk. And sometimes, why do you work? What's the point of the work? So another story, which is about right livelihood, be able to give everything when you're at work, when you get home, everything when you get home, was a story which is a quite moving story when I first read this, and I've told it a few times and got people to burst out crying. One of the problems of our modern life. There's a man came home from work. You know, sort of right livelihood, but he didn't quite get it. You'd think it was right livelihood, a good job, working hard for his family to try and make enough money so his kids could get a good education and get started in life. You know what people do. Parents think they should be responsible, which they are, but they get it wrong. How to be responsible? Thinking that just making money is all you need to do. So when he came home from work one day, his six-year-old son was waiting for him. His dad came in late. And his son said, "Daddy, Daddy, how much do you earn at work?" And the father said, "Look, you're only 6 years of old. It's nothing to do with you. Just go away, I'm tired." And the child said again, "Daddy, how much dollars do you earn at work?" And Daddy, just coming home from work, tired, stuck in the traffic, got irritated. "Look, I told you, son, shut up. Be quiet." "But Daddy, how many dollars do you earn every hour?" "That's it. Three times. Go up to your room. You're grounded." Daddy got angry because his six-year-old was pestering him and was being disobedient. So the six-year-old went up to his room. And after having a cup of tea, the daddy realized that he got angry at his own son simply because he was tired. Most of your anger just comes from tiredness, which is one of the reasons why if you learn how to do a little bit of meditation, you learn to change the way you struggle through life. You don't get so tired. You don't get so grumpy and angry. You don't take it out on your family. A lot of times you get angry at your wife, the wife gets angry at the husband, you all get angry at the kids simply because you're so tired. And you've lost your resilience. I'm going off on a tangent here. I'll finish the story in a moment. A couple of years ago, I was doing a youth session with about 300 15 to 25-year-olds in Malaysia, Chinese Buddhists. And during this one-day seminar, we asked them a question. What is your biggest emotional problem in life? We thought it would be depression, anger, maybe lust because, you're a boy and a girl looking for one another. And the clear winner, this is 15 to 25-year-olds in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, modern city, modern times, probably no different if we did this survey in Toronto between 15 and 25-year-olds. The biggest problem was tiredness. All these 15 to 25-year-olds saying they were so tired. The pressures of school, the pressures of their social life, the pressures of everything made them so exhausted. Do you recognize that in your life as well? How tired you are? That's why you get grumpy. That's why you get sick. That's why you get angry. The biggest scourge of our modern world, which creates a lot of cancers, depressions, breakup of relationships, kids going off the rails, is simple, tiredness. We work too hard, we don't work efficiently, we come home really worn out, and we live like that for most of our life. I had a plan once just to get a retreat center outside every city in the world. And just all I have there is comfortable beds in a quiet place where you can just sleep as much as you like. You can have breakfast any time of day, lunch any time of day, dinner any time of day. So you have no schedules at all. Blackout mobile phones, no internet, no services at all. So you can just sleep as much as you want and relax. I'd make a fortune if I wasn't a monk. Sleep centers. Wouldn't you like to go there for a holiday? Yeah. 3 or 4 days, I just sleep, eat whatever I like when I want to. No pressure at all. I don't have to get up in the morning. I can go to bed whenever I want and just sleep comfortable beds. Wow. That's one of the problems with people. We work too hard. That is wrong livelihood. But anyway, back to this story. Guy came home really tired, and that's why he got angry. He realized that, so he went up to the son's bedroom to apologize. Sorry, son. I shouldn't have shouted at you. It's just tired. I had a busy day, and it was so tiring. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. And look, I don't know why a 6-year-old boy wants to know this, but I earn $20 every hour at work. And the boy smiled and said, "Thank you, Daddy. Can I now please borrow $10? And straight away, the father was going to get angry, but he'd already got angry once. And he thought, I can't get angry again. So he bit his lip, opened up his wallet, and gave a $10 note to his 6-year-old son. And then his son said, "Thank you, Daddy," and opened a little drawer by his bedside and took out some coins and counted out another $10. With the $10 he'd got from his father, he counted out $20, gave it to his father, and said, "Daddy, can I now please have 1 hour of your time?" Do you understand? It's a beautiful story. Because right livelihood, you're doing this for your kids, but you're kidding your kids. So look, why does a kid have to pay his father $20, because that's how much he costs at work, to find 1 hour of time? So right livelihood is actually having enough time for the people you love. Enough time for yourself as well to rest and relax. That is right livelihood. It doesn't matter what livelihood it is. So like I'm telling a lot of people, if you're going for the promotion at work, give it up. Haven't you got enough stress already? Why do you want to be a boss or a manager? It sounds nice. You feel proud of your achievement, but you're kidding yourself and you're kidding your family. Is that what life is all about? So sometimes, you know, just don't go for the promotion. Stay just middle somewhere. The middle way is the best. Middle management, not top management. Which means that you have time and no stress. And look, people say, "But I have to get that advancement, that promotion, because I need the money." You never have enough money. I said that this afternoon. It's better the not enough money you're earning now than the not enough money you will earn with your promotion. However much it is, it's not enough. Am I right? How many people are earning enough money right now? How many people are earning too much? Okay, donation box is over here. You know, it's true that I read this much research in social science has proved, this is fact, there's an optimum salary for a human being, either individual or family. Some years ago, in Australia, it was about $50,000 a year for an individual, and something about $80,000 a year for a family. This was some years ago. I don't know about Toronto what the cost of living is. But if it was too under that, you know, it was a struggle to get by. You couldn't buy your kids things, so they had peer pressure in school for not having the same stuff as their friends had. You couldn't sort of, you know, get a reasonable house. You couldn't have holidays in Sri Lanka or wherever you want to go. Why do you go to Sri Lanka to have a holiday? Why do you go anywhere to have a holiday? You spend so much money on your house, and it's such a beautiful place. There's no place like home. There's no bed in any hotel in the world as comfortable as your own bed in your own room. So why is it you spend all that money on the house, making the garden, making it clean, as soon as you have a holiday, you're out, you're gone? Doesn't make any sense to me. The next time you have 2 weeks off, stay at home. Have a holiday in your own house. You don't have to go through the customs in the airport and the passport checks and the body pat downs. You don't have to wait in the queue and in the line and find out your aircraft has been delayed an hour or 2 hours. You don't have to sit next to this really fat guy in economy class. That happened to me, you know, some years ago. I was flying all the way from Thailand to London. And I had a window seat. And sitting next to me was this, please excuse me, enormous woman. And you know what happens when you want to go to the toilet? You know, people don't get off their seat, they just move their legs around and expect you to sort of squeeze past them. This woman, no one could squeeze past her. Impossible. And I really needed to go to the toilet. So I waited, you know, it's about 12 hours, I think, all the way from Bangkok to London. Waited and waited, bursting, but, you know, I had control. I was a monk. Waited and waited and waited. And when she got up to go to the toilet, I made a dash for it. And I made sure I did my business quick, because once she sat down, there's no way I could get back to my seat. And I did it. I made it. There's a lot of problems traveling all over the world like that. So, your own home. You've got a nice home. It's comfortable. You spend so much money. Enjoy it. But why is it that people can't stay in their home and just relax and enjoy it? Crazy, isn't it? The answer is this. I got this because I've been stupid too. I have a beautiful monastery in Australia. In the forest, spent lots of time building it up. And anyone who's visited my monastery, has anyone here visited my monastery in Australia? Wow, this is about the third or fourth time I've come here. I've come in here so often, you haven't come to visit me. So anyway, we've got a very beautiful monastery. And all these visitors come and say, wow, your monastery is so beautiful and so peaceful. And I tell them, are you kidding? There's so much work to do in this monastery. You know, you've got to clean the place up, you've got to maintain all the gutters and sweep all the paths and maintain the buildings, and you've got to answer the question of all these monks, and they've got to answer your questions as well and counsel you and do stuff for you. This is hard work, running a monastery. And I realized I had wrong livelihood as a monk. I was getting stressed out. I could never see my monastery as beautiful and serene. You could, but I couldn't, because my monastery was a place of work. Always jobs to be done. And I realized I was being stupid. So what I did, for one morning every week, usually a Monday morning, I pretended not to be an abbot of a monastery, but to be a visitor to the monastery where I lived. When I became a visitor, my whole attitude changed. Because I didn't live in the monastery, it was beautiful. This is a beautiful temple. You ask this monk, oh, so much work to be done here, so much cleaning, so much fundraising, we've got to do this, we've got to pay off the mortgage, oh, it's a headache. When you visit a monastery, it's serene and peaceful. When you own it, it's a lot of work. So one morning a week, I pretended not to own my monastery, just a visitor. So if I saw some rubbish on the path, not my monastery, I'm not going to pick it up. When you guys came and said, oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you a question? Sorry, I don't live here, I'm only a visitor. Ask another monk. Not my problem. And when I was a visitor to the monastery in which I lived, it became beautiful and serene. And I could see its beauty, I could see its peace, feel its peace, but not when I was an owner. So I tell people, the house in which you live, spend one morning every week pretending you're visiting your own house. You are not the owner of it. If you visit somebody else's house and have dinner,
How many of you wash the plates and dishes after, no, not in your own house, in somebody else's house? How many of you, after you visit somebody else's house just for a cup of coffee, take out the vacuum cleaner and clean their carpets? How many of you, when you go to somebody else's house, do the gardening for them? Of course you don't do that unless you're crazy, unless it's maybe your son's or your daughter's house. If it's a friend's house, they invite you for dinner, they do the washing up. You're only visiting. They just clean up after. They vacuum the carpet. They do the garden, not you. You're just visiting. So when you pretend to be a visitor to your own house, you can have a cup of coffee and you don't wash up the dishes. I'm only visiting. I'm enjoying it. You have a dirty stuff on the carpet. It's not my house. Lots of muck in the garden. Well, not my problem. I'm only visiting. I don't live here. That's the only way you can get some peace and quiet. When you look at your house as a visitor with visitor's eyes, not an owner's eyes. So if you want to have less stress in your life, when you go home, pretend to be a visitor. And then you don't have to keep managing your house. It doesn't become another place where you work. You work in the office, you work whatever job you do. When you go home, more work. It's work, 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 work. No wonder you get stressed out. That's wrong livelihood. And you only do that for one morning in a week. You can clean up afterwards. But it does mean, because you're not an owner, you can be free. For those people downstairs just under meditation, that's how you meditate. As a visitor to your own mind, not an owner. It's not my problem. I'm thinking, crazy, going asleep. It's okay, I'm only visiting. I don't have to do anything. Therefore, I can rest and relax and have a bit of rest so I don't get angry and upset and have all these emotional problems afterwards. So that's the simile of being a visitor, not an owner. And anyway, all these jobs which you do, all these jobs which you do in your life, why do you keep doing so much? I have a saying which I want you to remember and practice. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. Why do we always keep getting things out of the way? And we never have any rest and peace at all. The only people who rest in peace in Toronto are found in the cemetery. R.I.P. Can't you rest in peace while you can enjoy it? While you're still alive? So this is the way you can actually find some resting in peace. And if you rest in peace, where at home, on holidays, you find you've got more energy in your work. You can actually have a great career. You're efficient. You have the right livelihood. Because when you go to work on a Monday morning, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, whatever it is, you find you've got energy because you've rested at home. Why is it, again, that people don't perform? Because they're tired. The other way of right livelihood is, do you remember when you went to school? When you went to school, did they teach you one lesson after another, back to back all day, or did you have recess? Playtime. That was really important, because if you had a break after a couple of lessons, any child psychologist, any neurologist knows your brain cannot take such continual work one after the other, hour after hour. You get tired, you get exhausted, and your brain does not perform to its potential. You need a rest. If you had a rest at work every day, then you will find that that break would mean after you return to your computer screen or your desk, you'll find having rested, your brain is more efficient, can work with greater productivity in less time. Half an hour of rest is made up afterwards with 3 hours work done in 2 of high quality. I've taught that for a long time. It's now in Harvard Business School blog. It's called An Investment of Time for the Afternoon. Half an hour break, you make up. Have you ever noticed sometimes when you're really exhausted and tired, you can't produce your best work? You can be on that computer screen, just the ideas don't come. Even the words don't arrive in your brain because you're exhausted. It's absolutely stupidity that we work. Instead of just having a rest. And even better, instead of just having rest, having some joy as well. Please, and I do lots of talks to corporate people, they do get on places like MIT and Harvard Business School. If you're running a corporation, if you want to do the cutting edge, introduce in your office, in your company, playtime every morning and every afternoon for a quarter of an hour. Get all the executives, all the staff have to go and kick a football around or, you know, just run around like you used to do when you were kids. Have playtime. You will find your profits will go up. You will find you're far more productive. You will find that joy and happiness means you have a much more cohesive workforce, which doesn't get so angry at each other just because of exhaustion. And you have people working in your company who go home not tired, but have time for their kids and time for each other, and they rest well at night. It's efficiency, that's all. And for a monk, it's so obvious that when you're tired, you don't perform, you make mistakes, and that is devastating for your company. If Lehman Brothers had introduced my idea of playtime in the morning or the afternoon, it would not have gone bankrupt. But, you know, the type of work you do, again, you can see here, it's not what you do, but how you do it makes it right livelihood or wrong livelihood in your life. We all have a job to do, but it's how we do it makes a whole difference. And don't judge your job because you are a great executive. You are the Prime Minister of Canada. It doesn't matter what you do. It's always how you do it makes all the difference in the world. So when you talk about right livelihood, that is the key. Whatever you do in life, give it energy and also give it fun. Sometimes people are just so serious in whatever they do in life. I'm a very serious monk. I like telling jokes. You know, one of the reasons why I tell jokes, because that makes me successful. You know, happiness is success. Sometimes the people said, now, does success come before happiness, or happiness come before success? What is success in life? Have you arrived yet? You know, they have this word, to arrive means you've got there, you've got your mansion, you've got your car, you've got your private plane. You know, I've got a plane which takes me everywhere. It's called Air Canada. Who wants a private plane? Sometimes people ask me, when you go overseas, do you have people travel with you, your bodyguards, your hairdresser, your personal team maker? Me, hairdresser? No, it's wonderful. This is the greatest haircut ever. It's really good. It means you don't have to brush your hair, which means when you don't have to wash your hair. I just stand under the shower every morning, wash my body and the hair at the same time. And you women, you never have a bad hair day when you have it like this. You should all be bald. If you're really bald, it's great. You don't have to actually worry about hairdressers. It's shave it off. It's very quick every morning. And whenever you want to change your style, be a brunette, be a redhead, just get wigs. Get a whole line of wigs. And you can change your hairstyle every day. So it's a really great way. You know, these are things which, you know, you can send to the, you can actually, can you put a wig in a washing machine just to clean it? You don't have to worry about cleaning your own hair. And it costs so much money going to hairdressers. How much does it cost to go to a hairdresser these days? $30? $50. What a waste of money. Can you afford that? If you can't, it's much better to give that $50 to the temple and just shave off. So, actually, it's always like raising funds for things. And sometimes I'm invited always back again because I raise funds for people. And one of my stories which really raises funds, that's my job. This is my right livelihood, encouraging people to be generous. One of my favourite stories for encouraging people to be generous is the story of the spider. Because in the house I'm staying to, they were saying all the spiders were outside. I said, why do you destroy their webs for? Now these spiders, they do something good for you. They catch all the bugs. And these spiders, they don't do any harm. They just stay in a little corner somewhere. Why can't you, as Buddhists, leave them alone? And you know, there's once a spider, a young one. This young female spider, she found a nice little corner in a nice house in Toronto and built its first web. It put so much time and energy into building this web that when it was finished, it was such a beautiful web. If there was a magazine equivalent to Home and Garden, it would have been featured on the front cover. It was an artistic and architectural masterpiece. And so that little spider, having spent all that time making its first house, you remember your first house and how proud you were, especially if you built your first house? That's what the spider felt, and went to move in, sat in the court in the middle, waiting for lunch. Because you know that's what happens. The flies and other bugs fly in there, and that's the spider's lunch. Before it found anything to eat, the owner of the house saw a spider web in the corner, took the broom and smashed it to bits. And that poor spider had to run for her life. Got really close to being squashed. And that spider, undaunted, went into the house next door, built another web. Not as nice as the one before. And as soon as it finished, again, exhausted, sat in the middle waiting for lunch. And then the woman of the house saw it and screamed, "Spider!" And her husband came in and smashed it to bits again. Went to the next house, the fourth house, fifth house, six houses it went in. And every time it worked so hard building a nice web, and every time, as soon as it was finished, before I had anything to eat, was smashed to bits. After six houses, it wasn't just the spider gave up. That spider was terrified of corners, had post-traumatic stress. Imagine that was you, traumatized six times in the same day, your house smashed to bits. Of course, you know, it was paranoid of a corner. Every time it saw one, it would start shaking in fear. Not only that, that poor spider was so tired, hadn't had any time to rest, and was so hungry, hadn't had anything to eat. So that poor spider got so depressed. No one loves spiders. No one likes us. What we're doing, we're just taking a tiny corner of these big houses in Toronto. Just a tiny little space in the ceiling. People live on the floor, they don't live up here. We catch bugs for them. They don't want those bugs. We catch them, eat them, we recycle. And do people like us? They hate us. No one likes spiders. Yeah, but you're weird. But you're good, okay. Most people don't like spiders. They hate us. I'm so hungry, so rejected. They don't have a counselling hotline for spiders. So the spider got more and more depressed and it started to think about how hungry and lonely it was. The spider became suicidal. Became suicidal spider. And suicidal spider decided, I might as well end my life now. What's the point? I'll never find a place to stay. I'll never find
any food. I never find any love. So a suicidal spider walked on the sidewalk, trying to crawl under people's feet on purpose, trying to be squashed. But every time it managed to find its way in the space between the sole and the heel, the safe place, and not being able to be squashed on the sidewalk, decided to cross the road. Every time it crossed the road trying to get squashed by a car or by a truck, it always found the place between the wheels, never underneath the wheels. Because you will find, I hope you never have to, that when you are depressed, you can't do anything right, not even suicide. So, eventually, this poor old spider even gave up trying to commit suicide and was staggering along the road like some drunk person. Staggering, crying, feeling depressed. And then the suicidal spider, it felt that someone was looking at it. And it turned around, and there was the fattest, happiest spider who ever existed, out on the sidewalk, sunning itself, looking down at the miserable suicidal spider. And the happy, jolly spider said, "What's wrong with you? Why are you crying?" And suicidal spider told the sad, pathetic story of its short life, never having any respect or love, never having any food or a place to stay. It was homeless. And then suddenly, the suicidal spider looked up and said, "Hey, you're fat and happy. How come? When you built your web, didn't people destroy it?" And the fat, jolly spider said, "No, I've only built one spider web in my whole life, and it's still there. No one disturbs me, and I've got plenty of food. I've got so much food. Why didn't you come in here and stay with me?" And the suicidal spider said, "I'd like to, but first of all, I have to know, where in Toronto can you build a spider's web where no one ever disturbs you?" "Oh, that's easy to answer. I built my spider's web in the donation box of the West End Temple in Mississauga. No one ever disturbed you in there." Is that true, Venerable? Yeah. So you've got right livelihood and you've got, you know, too much money, because what I was saying is that 50,000 that we used to be or whatever, if you get too little, it's too hard to get by, but too much is actually too much problems, too much worry. You have to know, where can I invest this, and, you know, what sort of company, what stocks and shares, what can I do to keep this money rolling over? You have to keep watching the stock market, always watching Bloomberg or whatever else it is to try and find out where you're going to invest and how you can make sure this money will last for a long time. And there's so many crooks out there, you've got to be really careful. Even in all these wealth management funds, you know, can you be really sure they're going to be, you know, actually in your interest, or they're in their own interest? See how much they can cream from your hard-earned money. If you have lots of money, it's a big burden. So that's why too much is a lot of suffering, too little is a lot of suffering. There is, like everywhere else, a middle way. And I think the middle way was somewhere around, for a family, probably got up now, maybe about 100,000. That's the best. More than that, you're going to suffer. Less than that, you're going to suffer. So anyway, I'm sure there's a few people in my audience who are earning more than $100,000 a year. And if you are, you are suffering. And I can help you. Because that's part of my job as a monk, to relieve suffering. So if you're earning more than $100,000, you can give the rest to the temple. And you will have much more happiness in life. And so will the temple, but not the spiders. They'll get just... So, a lot of right life, don't worry about the money, worry about the happiness. You know that people keep saying, and it's true, the job satisfaction is more than the money. So are you satisfied with your job? If you're working, 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 but you hate your job, that's not right livelihood. No matter how much you're earning. Look at me. My salary is zero.
I'm one of these monks who doesn't accept any money. You can send it to my temple, but I don't receive any of it. I'm the poorest person in this whole room. Maybe except the other monk. Look, even my robe is ripped. Where is it? Somewhere over here. I've got a hole in it somewhere. Even I've got a ripped robe. So I'm really, really poor. But even though being a monk, the salary is hopeless. But the retirement benefits are out of this world. And the job satisfaction is immense. My job satisfaction is way through the roof. That's why I like being a monk. I'm not a monk because I had to be. Some people ask me that question. I jump on, why did you become a monk? And one theory is there was a love affair went wrong. My girlfriend dumped me, and I became a monk to forget. Isn't that romantic? You know, I'm not sure. It could be true. Because now, after 40 years, I've forgot. It's consistent.
But no, I didn't do that. I became a monk because I enjoyed it.
But the job satisfaction, that's why people say, why? No, I've got a great degree from Cambridge University in UK. I'm a clever guy. But why did you give all that away? Even my ideas for business. Now, I've got a good idea for modern Buddhism. All of you people have a very hard time finding time to get to the temple. You're very busy. So why don't we have a drive-in Buddhist temple?
You've got it, Mac Buddhas.
In Mac Buddhas, you drive in, and you've got this big board with the choice, what you want. No, pirit thread, holy water, chanting, and under chanting, what for? Chanting for a job, for health, for somebody who's died, how long they've died. You do the buttons, and then, you know, they ask, do you want holy water with that? If you want holy water, a little nozzle comes out and squirts you. And then you get the headphones, you get perfect pirit chanting when you want. You don't have to invite the monks to your home for all of that. And at the end, you've got the donation box. You put your money in, you go. Drive-in Buddhist temple. Would that be good? Even counselling. Got a whole list of counselling. Wife trouble, husband trouble, kid trouble, boss trouble. And you find it's all the same, which advice would you get, because it's all... That's my idea. You know, you can make a lot of money that way. It'd be very popular in Toronto, New York, San Fran, all these busy places. We haven't got time, have you, to go to the temple? But no, don't do stuff like that. It takes away the heart of it. But, you know, it's a great business model. So I had all these great ideas. You know, I'd have been a billionaire as a businessman if I wasn't a monk, but I wouldn't have any job satisfaction. That's so important in life. When you go home on a Friday, it's not the money you earn, it's what you've done for your family, for the country, for whatever. That is more important than the money. And people in business school tell me, research, that you're likely to keep people on, not on how much you pay them, but on their job satisfaction at work. People are likely to take a cut in their salary if they get better job satisfaction. So that is also right livelihood. There's this beautiful thing called how you feel about yourself at the end of the week. And don't worry about the money. That will come by itself later on. You never have enough. But all of you, I mean, I've seen this also in Toronto. Australia is the worst in the world for having big houses. But you've got pretty big houses here in Toronto too. Why are you doing that? You have to work really hard for a big house to pay it off, and your wife or you have to work so hard keeping it clean. There was a lady over in England who won the British lottery. I think it was £46 million British pounds she won. Would you like to win £46 million?
Trick question, don't answer. But she won 46 million. The first thing she did was buy a big mansion in the countryside. After 1 year, she sold that mansion at a huge loss. And she got interviewed in the newspapers. Why did you sell the mansion? And the article, which I've got in my monastery, was called, "Honey, I Can't Find the Kids." It was such a huge mansion that her three children, one was in one set of rooms, another was in another part of the mansion, another was in a third part of the mansion, the husband was in his part of the mansion, she was in her part of the mansion. They never saw each other. The hugeness of their house was separating their family. She hardly ever saw her husband, the house was so big, let alone her kids. So she sold it and bought a very tiny house so she could see her husband and her kids many times each day. There's many people from Sri Lanka here. You remember where you grew up? Maybe in a small house, your mum, your dad, your uncles, and also from Malaysia, Singapore, wherever you're from. Remember those days we had small houses? And I grew up with my brother. We had to share a small room. It's a council flat. You could probably put about 30 of those flats in this room where I grew up. Because I had to share the room with my brother, we fought. But we love each other to bits now. We always saw your mum and dad. I used to see my mum and dad shouting at each other and arguing. But I also saw my mum and dad making up afterwards. They couldn't escape from their kids, and the kids couldn't escape from them. What I learned was it's natural to have arguments, but it's beautiful to see people making up. That was worth the argument, to see my mum and dad hug and kiss and say sorry to each other. That's what I learned as a kid living in a small house. You don't see that in a big house, in a big mansion. Huge houses are breaking up families. Small houses, you have to learn how to live with each other, and my goodness, you do. And you learn so many social skills growing up in a small house. You also save a lot of money too. Small is beautiful. Environmentally, you're not wasting so many of Earth's resources. So you don't need the big job and get the big house. What are you doing that for? It's just pride, showing off. My house is bigger than your house. Nah, 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 nah. That's crazy stuff. Small is beautiful. And what you do is in a small house, you create a beautiful family. Job satisfaction, family satisfaction as well. How many people have problems with their kids? How many people have difficulty living with a wife, with a husband? That never used to be the case. You know why? Because our houses are too big. We don't have enough time with each other. We're too busy making more money to buy the big house, which is separating the people we love and care for the most. Craziness. So, downsize. Live more simply. And then you don't need a big job with lots of money. And you have plenty to spare. And you're with a nice family. You learn the skills, and your kids learn the skills, how to love each other. Because you can't run away. I couldn't run away from my brother. He couldn't run away from me. There's only one thing left, to love each other. So when we want the right livelihood, don't go for the big jobs. Don't go for promotions, and don't think about money. Think about family. Think about sort of stuff which is more important, time. I mean, I say these days we're rich in money, poor in time. Can't we turn that around? Can't we just downsize our expectations? Can't we have time with each other? Have a livelihood, which is not just at work, it's not just what you do in the office, it's what you do outside as well is your livelihood. And that way, you'd eventually get your happiness. It doesn't come straight away, it comes later on. The last story I'm going to tell is, again, I'll tell some funny jokes. This is a funny joke, but it also shows that whenever you do something, do good karma, it takes a while before you get the reward. It was a case of a migrant worker came to Toronto. You know, migrants, sometimes it's hard to get their first job, so they,
They got a job on a building site, a construction worker, a labourer. And this poor guy from some Middle Eastern country, he worked so hard all day on Monday. When he got home, his wife said, "How much did you earn today, darling?" He said, "Nothing. I worked all hard, they didn't give me anything." So he went to work on Tuesday, the same building site. He worked just so hard, he was sweating and dirty. When he went home, "How much did you get today?" "Nothing," he said. He tried again on Wednesday, still get anything. And he told his wife, "I'm giving up this working in Toronto, they don't give you any money." But his wife said, "Well, you've got nothing else to do, you might as well work on Thursday as well." So he went to work on Thursday, still nothing. He just didn't have anything else to do, so he went to the building site on Friday. And at the end of Friday, the boss gave him this big pay packet. When he went home, he told his wife, "I finally learned how it works in Toronto. From now on, I'll only go to work on Fridays." Now, if you're a migrant worker, sometimes, you know, you may get the idea. You don't know how it works, because on Friday you're paid for all the work you did on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. That's the law of karma. Sometimes if you do these practices, you don't get instant pay packet. You just keep on going, going, going. Sometimes people do that. We asked for some charge, we give a donation, it didn't work. We didn't get a pay packet. You got to do the donation Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Friday you get the pay packet. Do the good kindness, the goodness, the service, the generosity, the forgiveness. Do it many times. The pay packet is coming. The paycheck is in the mail. Have you ever been told that? It's in the mail. It actually is. It's coming. So when right livelihood, you do the right thing, eventually you get the paycheck. And it's not money. Job satisfaction, happiness, a good family. Isn't that more important? Then you truly are a rich man, a rich woman. Time for your family, beautiful family. You know, if you want to worry about your retirement, your children are the ones who will choose your nursing home. So you better look after your kids. Thank you for listening. So now we have half an hour or a little bit more for questions. Questions and answers. Yeah. A happy medium. This is the happy medium, being a monk. Or a nun. No, happy medium, we all choose a little bit of each. So some people go for being a monk and get huge job satisfaction. Some people choose for working, and maybe they've only got a little time for the temple. So they usually send money to the temple because they've got no time to get there. And sometimes people can come to the temple and get some good teachings, get some inspiration, and do the work. They have both. It's amazing how much spirituality now goes into big business. And you know, how companies like Samsung, you have to be a meditator to work in Samsung in Korea. Other companies like Dell have a time out room where anyone, any time of the day, can go into that time out room to relax and rest so they can perform well afterwards. It's not taking out off your salary, off your time you have to do at work. Let's realize that's a wise thing to do. Spirituality and business are coming together because they have to. Business is crazy without spirituality, and spirituality is poor without business. We need each other. So it is a symbiosis. There's a few questions down here. I've got one here. Please pass this on to the stage, Rajan Brown. Here we go. Please pass this on. What's this one? Here we go. Dear Ajahn Brown, thank you so much for coming to Toronto. In your talk yesterday, you said that in marriage, it is always about us. That's fine. But how do you deal with a partner who says that the moment you get married, you must lose everything about self and expect you to compromise on basic elements of your principles of integrity, such as stopping prayers or believing in God or caring for your parents, as such activity takes time away from the marriage? What do you say to that person? Tell a story. Some years ago, there was an Italian Catholic married a Thai Buddhist in my hometown of Perth. And they both loved each other, and they came to one of the monks and asked, "I'm an Italian Catholic, my wife's a Thai Buddhist, what should we do?" And this monk gave some beautiful advice. He said, "On Saturdays, both of you should go to the Buddhist temple. Even though you're a Catholic, you go to the Buddhist temple. On Sundays, both of you go to church. You know, you're a Thai Buddhist, but you go to the church. Because you have to learn how your husband thinks. And husband, you have to learn your wife's culture. Go together." And that's a beautiful piece of advice. Because real religion shouldn't be separating people, but should be bringing people together. And if you can do things like that, you understand what real spirituality is about. In Buddhism, we have to say, "May all beings be happy and well." You know, may all beings be happy and well? That includes Muslims. It includes Catholics, Christians, non-believers, everybody. It's not just when you say, "May all beings be happy and well," it just means us Buddhist. When in Christianity you say, "Love your neighbor as yourself," it means love the Buddhist as yourself and everything else. So if people actually read their teachings and actually followed them, there'd be no trouble at all. Religion shouldn't be separating people. The reason why it does separate people can be understood from the following story. Do you remember many years ago, you know, when actually it's still the Americans are running Guantanamo Bay and putting, you know, their so-called terrorists incarcerated in there? And some years ago, there was a story which was distributed worldwide that the American Marines had taken a copy of the Quran, the Muslim holy book, put it in a toilet and flushed it down the toilet. Do you remember that? And there were riots all over the Muslim world. And even in Australia, it was front page news. And one journalist from the national newspaper in Australia called me. He said he was doing an article asking the leaders of all the major religions in Australia, and you know, we're the second religion, we're more Buddhists in Australia than Muslims and Jews. There's a huge number of Buddhists in Australia. So you know, I was one of the leaders, so I could speak English, so he rang me and said, "Look, I've been asking the same question of all these religious leaders, I'm now going to ask you. Please answer directly. If someone took a copy of your holy book, a Buddhist scripture, and flushed it down your toilet, Ajahn Brahm, what would be your reaction? What would you do?" Without any hesitation, I replied to this journalist, "If someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down my toilet, the first thing I would do is call a plumber." We are very practical in this religion. I have to use that toilet. And I remember that journalist bursting out laughing on a very serious issue. I'm going to print that. That's the first sensible answer I've heard all day. Never let religion stand in the way of a good joke. And then I got serious. And this is the important part, the serious part of this. I said, "Sir, you can flush as many Buddhist books as you like down my toilet. You can burn down the Buddhist temples. You can smash the Buddha statues. You can even kill the Buddhist monks or nuns. But I'll never allow anybody to destroy Buddhism. I never allow anyone to flush down peace, forgiveness, kindness down any toilet. Because there's a difference between the container and the contents. The books are containers. What does it say in those books? Why is it that we worship the books and we don't worship what's actually said in the books? Why is it that we worry about a Buddha statue being destroyed? We don't remember what the Buddha would say. It doesn't matter about being destroyed. When the Bamiyan Buddhas were destroyed, it took about 4 or 5 days. In those 4 or 5 days, the Buddhist artists were very busy making about 2,000 other statues. We lost 4, we gained 2,000. We don't worry. This is what does this statue mean? What do the monks preach? What's the purpose of this temple? So when you understand the difference between the container which is temples, which is books, which is monks and nuns, statues, and the contents, which is the peace, forgiveness, the love, the compassion. When we understand that difference, then we understand how to stop such wars, misunderstandings, just hatred, jealousies, fears. And also when a person gets married, you can say, if you want to go to the Buddhist temple, fine. If you want to go to the church, fine. As long as you remember the contents and forget about the containers. And any place which talks about peace and kindness and forgiveness, the development of wisdom, the development of freedom, great, that's a wonderful place to go. So I've got many friends who are Muslims. And even, you know, the current crisis and problems in Syria and Iraq. On the way from Australia to London, and from London to here, on the way to Australia, I flew over Syria and Iraq. And my friends knew that. And they said, aren't you going to be afraid? Someone's going to shoot you down. Or what would happen if there was some emergency and I had to make a forced landing, an emergency landing in Baghdad? You know, I'm not only a Westerner, I'm an obvious non-believer in Islam, and I'm very well known. I'd be a great target for kidnap and ransom. You know, I've got many disciples, so I could actually raise a lot of money for ISIS if I was kidnapped. So I said, I have my plan. My plan, if my plane had emergency landing, you know, in Syria and I was captured, I'd use my robe. I'd cut a little slit in the front here, put it over my head, and it would be a burqa. And because it's a brown burqa, they wouldn't know, it's just fashion. They wouldn't know there was a bald-headed Caucasian monk inside. Like in this case. So you use your initiative. So again, in a marriage, it really has to be about us. For those who didn't hear this, when you get married, it's not about yourself. It's not about your partner. So I tell people when they're getting married, don't think of yourself, don't think of your partner, think of us. It has to be us. So if one of your partner wants to go to the temple or wants to go to the church, it's about us. The other person can't say no. And they shouldn't say no. And it's wrong to say no, because it's about us, it's our decision. So if you want to go to the temple, fine. And if Buddhism is really worth anything, you know, your wife, your husband goes to the temple, when they get home, they should be a much better husband or wife by going to the temple. Otherwise, what's the point of religion if it doesn't make you a better person? A more tolerant, more loving person. So that's one of the reasons why I love interfaith marriages. Is it absolutely true? I've got a disciple over in Singapore. She is a Buddhist. This is absolutely true. She married a Christian. They got two sons. One is a Hindu, one is a Muslim. And I've been encouraging them for the last couple of years, please have another child, make it a Jew, then you've got the full house. And they're happy together. Isn't that a beautiful sign of our times? So anyway, I better do some more questions, otherwise I keep going on with my jokes. This was earlier. I did this actually, upstairs. That's the question's done. Okay, this is a few questions from downstairs. Impermanence and unsatisfactory are very self-evident. Why is non-self such a difficult concept, and what are some ways to overcome this? I think I answered that question, didn't I, as well?
Yeah.
That one, are these all answered? Oh, do I need a master on the path to enlightenment? No, you don't need a master. There is an alternative. Get a mistress. A nun! Because they call monks who are teachers masters. So if it is a female, a bhikkhuni, a nun, who is your teacher, if monks are masters, then the nuns must be the mistresses. Isn't that right? Because a master is actually, this is especially in Mahayana Buddhism, you have a master. That just means teacher. So if you have a female master, it must be a mistress. So anyway, so you can get a nun, a mistress, to be your teacher on the path to enlightenment. But these days, it's so hard to get good teachers. So what do? You have the master called internet. Master YouTube. Because you get so many talks, you know, and teachings on YouTube. That's one of the reasons. I know that sometimes these monks, they keep saying, when are you coming back to Toronto? Look, I've got many countries I must serve. You know, when I leave here tomorrow afternoon, going to Montreal, from Montreal to Halifax to Germany, from Germany to London, to Cambridge, back to London, and then I go back to Perth, I've got a whole weekend next month, actually not this November, then going off to Kuala Lumpur, to Malaysia, and then December to Japan, and then back to Penang in the end of December, and then to Hong Kong, and then to Singapore, and then to Korea, and to Thailand. Oh, I forgot, San Francisco in February. Oh, yeah, absolutely true that my major carrier is Singapore Airlines. This is no joke. This year, I got a personal birthday card from Singapore Airlines. Have you ever got a birthday card from Air Canada? I travel so much, they know me so well. I'm like family, so they sent me birthday cards. When people say, where do you live, Ajahn Brahm? I say, in aircraft. I spend most of my life in there. So I just can't always come here. So instead of always coming here, you know, okay, every now and again you see me live, but you can see me on YouTube. And it's such a wonderful medium, because you can give a talk and it's about 40, 50,000 people listen to every talk. And I think we worked out there's always about 20, 30 people every second somewhere in the world listen to one of my talks. It's great, you don't need big halls. Give a talk, like here, record it, please upload it, so everyone can see it. And that means your master, your teacher, whoever they happen to be, is on the internet. And it's much easier having an internet teacher. If you're sitting here and you don't like it, it's embarrassing to walk out. If it's on the internet, delete. And you're never embarrassed. And it's also sometimes my accent, I might talk a bit fast or the microphone might not be working. You might miss something. On the internet, you can just wind back and get it again. You can have your, you know, your favorites, you know, which you take on your iPod, you know, to work, or on your smartphone. It's great, the internet. So you're a real master, and you can actually switch. There's many other great monks, great nuns, great teachers in this world. And so instead of having one, you have many. And you find when you go to university, well, I don't know what you studied. Suppose you studied engineering. How many teachers did you have when you're at university for engineering? Was it just one? Of course, every teacher is strong on one area and weak on other areas. That's why you have many different professors at university. So why not in Buddhism? Have a few of your favorite teachers, each strong in different areas, and then you can have many masters. Because seriously, in Buddhism we go for the three refuges, in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. You don't go for refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Ajahn Brahm. The Sangha, many monks, many nuns. That's the three refuges. So please remember that this is not a cult. You know, this is the Sangha. So please do not go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Dalai Lama, or whatever. Not the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Goenka. The Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Now that means you have a wide number of teachers, not one.
I got a question.
Yeah.
If I may.
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
particle physics, yeah.
In particle physics, like, for example, the eight-four-way combinement, the group theory for the quark.
Yeah, you know, when I was at Cambridge, that was flashed on the screen when they started mentioning quarks. That was in 1972 or one or something. And that's one of the first times I saw the eightfold path in university. They mentioned the quarks, the three and the eight different modes, and they put on the eightfold path of the Buddha.
Yes, yeah.
And I was in the lecture theatre, yeah!
Professor Murray Gell-Mann still reads about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I'm trying to find your guidance about how to find some resources or some guidance.
Mm. Yeah.
And the interconcentration between dimensions and the relativistic scale.
Yeah.
General relativity and so on.
You're talking my language, mate.
So, and I also find there are lots of the teaching of the Buddha has some, even though they don't have the connotation in the pure sciences, but they can be adopted. In the generality is explained, maybe the sciences can use that the teachings to develop new theories and find ways to find answers to the questions being asked.
Absolutely. I will give you one example right now, which I've been teaching a lot of people recently. God, creator of universe, the beginning of time. For a long time, people are trying to ask, where did we come from? What was the beginning? If there is a beginning, there has to be some cause for the first beginning. Big Bang, but what was before the Big Bang? A God, but who caused, or what caused God? It is one of those problems which doesn't really have a solution. Even Big Bang is not satisfying. The idea of a God is not satisfying. It just pushes the problem backward. It kicks the can down the road, backwards. But there is an answer. A Buddha answer, which dispenses with the need for a God, for a creator, or for a Big Bang. Many centuries ago, people thought planet Earth was flat. They thought that if you sailed from Europe far enough, you will fall off the edge. They thought the planet Earth had a boundary. And now we all know that planet Earth is spherical. It has no boundary, no beginning, no end to the surface of planet Earth. But then we thought, as I thought as a young man, certainly space has to have a boundary. And I imagined just going to the edges of space and finding a brick wall erected by some government saying, trespassers are prohibited from going beyond the end of the universe. Or some other sort of razor wire which prevented you. This was the end of the universe. You can't go further. How can there be an end of the universe? If there's a wall, if there's a boundary, you'll say, what's beyond the boundary? And again, in science class, it was explained to me like this. Imagine an ant crawling on a soccer ball, a basketball if you like. The ant walks round and round the soccer ball and realizes the area of the soccer ball is finite because it keeps going back on the territory it's already crossed. It's a finite area but has no boundaries. There's no beginning or end to the soccer ball. And that was the explanation of the fact that this universe in which we live is finite in volume. There's only a certain amount of space, but it has no boundaries. There's no beginning, no end to the universe in which we live. But it's finite. It doesn't go on forever, just like the soccer ball. It's a finite area with no beginning, no end, no edges, no boundaries. And that is how physicists understand space. Finite in volume, without any boundaries, no beginnings or ends. So why can't we just make the next jump to time? time, finite in duration, without any beginning, no end, no more than space has a beginning or end, neither does time. And if time has no beginning, no more do we need a God. Just as the Buddha said, beginningless time, endless time, no boundaries, no edges. That is intellectually satisfying. That answers the question. The thing about physics which I got was the problems of philosophy of life is because we don't see things in the right framework. We need to grow in our perceptual framework, the way we look at things. We need to understand just about compassion, expand what compassion means, understand it. Expand our understanding about space and time. No more do we need anything to begin this universe. God has now become redundant. And human beings, we are the creators. As one of the articles said, we actually create the past and the future. When we make an observation of the past or the future, Schrodinger's cat, we create it. The universe is not out there, but we're traveling in it. We actually create things. Each one of you are gods. Like it says in the Christian Bible, in the Psalms, be still and know that thou art God. That's in the Christian Bible. They get very embarrassed about that. But that's right there. And that's Buddhist. I agree with that. So I love the coming together of physics and Buddhism. It's brilliant. Especially modern physics. And that's why it answers some of the questions. What's Buddha's idea of God? Just told you. When there's no beginning to time, you don't need a God. Wow. Bamboozled you. Stretch your imagination. Wow. Isn't that cool? Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. But one of the other things about physics, you got me going now, is I don't know if you know Rupert Sheldrake. This was one of the physicists, or not physicists, he was a scientist from Cambridge. And you know TEDx channel, TEDx? Internet channel, cutting edge ideas. And he went on a TEDx channel, the only person on TEDx to be banned. His lecture was removed from the channel. And it was a brilliant piece of work because his whole work was that science is dogmatic. And they took it off the air. And he went on and said, there, proved it. You're dogmatic. You've censored me. And he made a great distinction in science between scientific method and scientific dogma, which could have been out of the mouth of the Buddha. Scientific method means everything has to be up for challenge. No dogma, whether it's reincarnation, Four Noble Truths, Nibbana, nothing is off the table. You've got to challenge everything in Buddhism. You don't do that in other religions. You challenge it and you get your head cut off. In Buddhism you get praise. Well done, keep on going. Unfortunate and scientific method. Scientific dogma is there's things taken for granted which you never question, such as the speed of light. But in particular, big G, the universal gravitational constant of Newton. You may remember that in your science class. Gravity, the force of between two massive objects, is equal to the product of their masses divided by the square of their distance apart, multiplied by this constant, the universal gravitational constant. And this Jojo from Cambridge, Sheldrake, is it a constant?
And there are facilities in most developed countries, scientists whose sole job is to keep measuring those constants year after year after year to check them out. And so Sheldrake went to so many countries, got all the data, all the measurements of Big G over the last 50 years, and discovered it has changed significantly. It changes in Toronto the same time it changes in London, the same time it changes in Singapore. It's been changing all the time. It is not a constant. What you've been told in school is not scientific. It is wrong. And that's a fundamental part of physics over which many other parts are built up. Even some of the foundations are faulty. But can you question that? No. Because that's too troublesome. Which is why science has become very dogmatic. Why a lot of people are questioning it. And this is guy, he's a whistleblower. And scientists don't like him at all. Buddhists, we love him. Because Buddhism, please do not be dogmatic. Challenge everything. God, Buddha, Dharma, everything is up for challenge. So I often tell people, Buddhism is more scientific than science. Because we've just continued not to have dogma, but to have the method of questioning, investigating, finding out. Sorry, Bhagavan, I love that sort of stuff. Bends the mind. Okay, let's do a question for you. I thought I might get another science question. Here we go. Do I need to become a monk on the path towards enlightenment? You don't need to become a monk or a nun. Somebody came from Chicago, somebody came from New Jersey. Are they still here from New Jersey?
In the basement.
Okay, those in the basement. You don't have to get an aircraft or a car to go to New Jersey. You can walk. But I would actually recommend getting an aircraft or a car. You don't have to become a monk to become enlightened, but I'd recommend it. It's the easy way. That's why the Buddha set up the Sangha of monks and nuns. It's like the aircraft towards enlightenment. It's like Buddha Air. But you know that you guys, you know, so you want to walk there, you're crazy. Does marriage cause a hindrance towards enlightenment? Not really, because when you get married, you have a much deeper understanding of suffering.
Oops.
You know about the person. So they never knew what happiness was until they got married. Then it was too late. I got a person, he always says that, friend, he used to hold his girlfriend's hand before they get married. You know when you're in love, you like to hold hands? They've been married 20 years, he still holds her hand. Isn't that sweet? But he doesn't hold her hand out of love. He holds her hand out of self-defense.
I do apologize. I'm a monk. I'm the least romantic person. It's okay. I do marriages and I work with you and make sure it works. So you do respect marriages, but you know, people like jokes. I find that some... Do you want a monk joke?
Okay. This is a joke from my father. It's not true, but it's funny. What fun does a monk have? The answer is none. That's not true. Monks are good. We leave our female monastics alone. Okay, here we go. I find that sometimes it was not I who makes the decision. What I mean is that there are times of during sitting meditation I decided I was not going to move, even if my legs are numb, but still the next moment I would have stretched out my legs. Who moved? I hope the question is clear. I know what you mean. Your will. Are you in charge? Do you make conscious decisions? If you did, there'd be no money to be made out of advertising. Advertising brainwashes you into buying those products.
But you all think you are too sophisticated to buy into those stupid ads on the TV. Those stupid ads, they're meant to be stupid, to actually to convince you. I'm not going to fall for that, but you do. When I was young, I fell for this stupid ad. I remember it. It was for St. Bruno Tobacco. In the days before they knew, or they knew, but they never told anyone that tobacco would give you cancer, they had this advertisement in Britain for St. Bruno Tobacco. You put it in a pipe. And that was cool in those days, especially at university. You know, it made you look like a professor. So the advertisement on TV had this ordinary-looking guy walking down the street. You know, they have these high streets, these narrow streets with all the shops in a line in London. Walking down the street, you know, minding his own business, and then he took out a pipe, put some Bruno tobacco in, and lit it. And the aroma, according to the marketing ploy, the aroma was irresistible to beautiful women. And so he walked past this shop where there's this gorgeous blonde in some newspaper shop. And she smelt this St. Bruno tobacco, jumped over the counter, and followed this guy, waiting to fulfill his every desire. And he went past another shop of greengrocer. There was this gorgeous, drop-dead gorgeous redhead. She too got entranced by the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco and also was following him. In 1 minute, this ordinary looking guy was followed by the most amazing girls you could ever imagine because St. Bruno tobacco was irresistible to the opposite sex. It's crazy, wasn't it? But you know who bought St. Bruno tobacco the next day? And it didn't work for me. Even the old lady selling the potatoes never jumped over and followed me. It was sexist, it was stupid, it was in the 60s or 70s. But I couldn't believe that I got pulled in by that. But you get pulled in with all of the advertising you see, and you don't realize it. By the time you go into the supermarket or the shops, you've already been told what to buy. And you don't realize it. Before you vote for the mayor, the election for the next mayor of Toronto, it's already been conditioned into you who you're going to vote for. The advertising. And we think that it doesn't affect us. That is the trick of advertising. It's been proved that advertising, you spend $1 in advertising, you always get $3 back in profits. It's highly lucrative. Why? Because it conditions you, and you don't realize it. You are being controlled. That's scary. All of you here today, you've been brainwashed by me. I know that, as I was brainwashed by my teacher, and he by his teacher. It's crazy, but if you are going to be brainwashed, brainwashed by someone wise and kind. That's trouble with terrorists. They don't realize that they're not acting out of free will. They think they're making a choice. They've been totally conditioned to act as they do. Do you see the light? I see the light over there, over there. The nimitta every time you meditate. Notice, as I said, sometimes you have to go to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday before you get the pay packet on Friday. How long does it take to reach the jhana stage from the start of meditation? Only one moment. That's all there ever is. There is no time when you meditate. No future, no past. Therefore, time disappears. In the present moment, there is no time. How long do you stay in the jhana stage? However long you like, but usually only one moment. Sometimes a moment lasts for days. I like telling this story. In Australia, three years ago, there was a monk, not one of our monks, he was actually a Vietnamese monk. He was teaching a 9-day retreat. On the 9-day retreat, usually people settle in, get into their rooms, and usually it's common to do a half an hour meditation and then the monk gives a talk to open up. After half an hour, the monk was still sitting in meditation.
and people were waiting to hear the talk. Another hour went past, the monk hadn't moved. He wasn't giving the talk, he was still meditating. After another half an hour, everyone went to bed. When they got up in the morning, the monk was still there, hadn't moved. He didn't move for 8 days. Didn't go toilet, didn't eat, just sat there 8 days. When he came out of his meditation, he apologized. "I'm so sorry, I just got into one of these deep meditations. I didn't give you any talks." And all the people there, "No, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." It's so inspiring to see that monks can do that these days. To sit perfectly still for 8 days, not moving, not drinking, not going to the toilet, not eating, perfectly still. So don't worry, if you've got to go home tonight, if you get into a jhana, we'll put you in a taxi, drop you at home, and when you come out of meditation, you're at home. Last question, from here. How can one be mindful and supportive of an individual who is always negative? Should you close yourself off from that person for your own well-being? Is that practicing loving kindness for yourself? What about the other person? There's a nice story in Buddhism. I've adapted it in my latest book about the elephant. So there's an elephant in Toronto Zoo, a very nice elephant, always allow the kids to play with it, and it's very gentle and kind. But one day, the elephant started to get mean. He squirted water at a boy, right in his face, and he pooed over his keeper. He started getting very nasty and mean, and the keeper thought he must be sick. So he got a doctor, a vet. Actually, it wasn't a he, it was a she elephant. So they thought he must be going through menopause. But,
a guy's joke.
And they realized it wasn't going through menopause, they couldn't find anything wrong with the elephant. It was just getting mean and nasty. And so, having gone through the doctors, they started getting elephant psychologists, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, teaching them elephant mindfulness, see if that would help. Nothing helped. The elephant grew worse and worse and worse and worse. Until eventually, they should have done this at first, they got one of the monks from the West End Temple to go and investigate. So this monk, you know, he went into the elephant enclosure and meditated there late into the night. And in the middle of the night, he heard a sound. And he crept behind the elephant enclosure. I'm not sure if this is in Toronto Zoo, because behind the elephant enclosure, there was a gardening shop which sold, you know, sort of flowers and pots and all sorts of fertilizer for the gardens. And he crept to the fence there, and he saw over the fence there was a gang of drug dealers. He realized garden pots was not the only pot they sold in that garden shop. Drug dealers came there. And they were not just talking about sort of selling all sorts of drugs to people, but who they were going to beat up who hadn't paid their drug debts. They were very nasty, mean people. And the monk realized why the elephant had got mean and nasty. So he called the police, had them all arrested, and the following day he got all the monks, you know, from the temples around Toronto to go there and chant Parit and meditate, spread loving kindness every night for a week, and every day the elephant grew kinder and softer until he was back into the ways he was before. It's adapted from a story, you know, in the sutras about the bad elephant, because even elephants, they pick up on the vibes of the people they live with. Simple, it's osmosis. If you're with kind people, you become kind. If you're with nasty, cruel people, you become nasty and cruel. You can't help it. Just like the advertisement, it's brainwashing, conditioning. So if you've got a negative person, it's because they're around negative people all the time. So bring them to Mississauga West End Temple. And they hang out here for a while, and they get off on the beautiful, kind vibes of the monks and the Buddha and the temple, and soon they get conditioned out of their negativity. So I told that to many people, and they said, "Oh, can we bring our son? Can we bring our husband? Can we bring all these other negative people to your monastery, Ajahn Brahm?"
So, well, you can, but their negativity will soon rub off on the monks.
And we'll start to get negative too.
But it's true that that's one way to overcome negativity. Be really positive, and people can't resist it. After a while, it rubs off. And that's one of the reasons I've been here today. Brainwashing you, having some of my kindness, some of my positivity, some of my laughter rubbing off on you. And even if you don't understand or agree with anything which I've said today, still, where it's come from is probably more powerful and hopefully has rubbed off. Thank you for listening.
Okay, so
well done.
I think I don't have to say thank you. With your big applause, it meant a big thank you to Ajahn Brahm. And he was teaching all day today, and we are so thankful and grateful to Ajahn Brahm. Thank you very much for making the deep teaching so simple. And as we all got them. And of course, in monastic way, in temple way, the way we say thank you to our great beloved teacher, Ajahn Brahm, is to say sadhu with the full energy. Okay?
Yes.
Three times, with the joint palm.
Sadhu! Sadhu! Sadhu!
Thank you.
Very good.